I'm Dr. Roger Steiner, director of the Gavin Herbert Eye Institute and professor and chair of ophthalmology at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome to Medscape Ophthalmology Insights, coming from the American Academy of Ophthalmology meeting in New Orleans. Joining me today are Nancy McCann and Dr. Brock Bakewell. Nancy is director of government relations at the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery. Dr. Bakewell is chair of the Government Relations Committee at the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery. He practices in Tucson, Arizona, specializing in cataract and refractive surgery and corneal disease at the Fishkind Bakewell Maltzman Eye Care and Surgery Center. We'll be discussing the Affordable Care Act and how it will impact ophthalmology, as well as the formation of Accountable Care Organizations, or ACOs. So I'd like to start by asking Nancy to help us with this alphabet soup, and what exactly is an ACO?
Okay, the ACO is an accountable care organization that is really part of the provision under the Affordable Health Care Act, which actually is the Medicare Shared Savings Program. So it is it was a pilot demonstration that's been expanded, and the concept is to try and control cost and quality of care by coordination of care with primary care and specialists. And so it started with the Affordable Health Care Law. It's grown. Depending on where you are in the United States, there may be one or two ACOs. Some of the markets, like in Boston, there are six, seven, and eight. And there are some parts of the country where there are none at all. And it's really, again, an effort to improve quality outcomes and control costs in the system. And then if, in fact, there is there's money saved at the end of the year, the savings goes back to the physicians that participate in the accountable care organization. And one thing that's really important that there's a lot of confusion about is it is based on fee-for-service. So it's not like a traditional HMO that tries to control the care by keeping the patient inside the HMO, if you will. So the patient can go outside of the accountable care organization at any time. They're not required to stay in the ACO and see only those providers. And there's a lot of confusion about that. And so it's really important to clarify that.
Well, Brock, I mean, I'm confused. Okay, I mean, now the ACOs are basically organized around primary care, correct?
Correct.
So we're ophthalmologists. How does this affect us?
Well, it is going to be difficult for us to participate in ACOs according to the way the laws are right now. The ACO is really built around specialists, and it's groups of physicians that take care of approximately 5,000 patients at a minimum is the smallest ACO group that you can provide for. At any rate, specialists will contract with ACOs. Originally, it was meant that ophthalmologists could, or specialists could, contract with multiple ACOs, but that's going to be very difficult the way it is right now, because as it stands, if you have a tax ID number, and if you contract with that ACO and you have that one tax ID number, then you can't contract with another ACO. So you either have to have multiple tax ID numbers, or you have to contract as what Medicare calls an other entity, which does not let you gain in any of the shared savings that come about from managing patients appropriately.
Oh, wow. So,
well, you know, actually, to kind of further piggyback on what Brock is saying, basically, the intent was, in the statute itself, the law, was that primary care could only be in one ACO, a full participant in one ACO and share in the savings, and specialists could be in more than one ACO. Unfortunately, the way CMS, which is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is implementing it, they're implementing it in a way that, regardless of specialty, as long as you bill for E&M, which is almost every specialty, maybe pathology, then you can only be in one ACO as a full participant. So in that case, what Brock was talking about was that if I'm in ophthalmology practice And we have signed on the dotted line as a full participant, meaning you share in the savings and the risks with an ACO. Once you are in that one ACO, you may not participate in any other ACO and share in the savings. Now again, you can provide care to other patients that are in other ACOs, because remember, the patient can go outside of an ACO at any time. It's just that you, as the ophthalmic practice, are set in with that ACO, and that's where the shared savings would come from. So ideally, you could participate, as Brock said, as an other entity. And an other entity is basically just a contract on a case-by-case basis with each ACO. But under that scenario, you could not share in the savings, because it's all based on the patients and which ACOs they're attributed to, which gets really, really complicated.
Well, first of all, okay, so you've been talking about shared savings,
right,
and emphasizing that, but there's also shared risk, isn't there?
It depends on the ACO model. There are two different ACO models. One is one-sided, which means that you only share in the savings at the end of the year. The other is a two-sided model, which you share in the savings and the risks. So that being said, at the end of the year, if indeed you do not save any money, okay, and you actually costs go up, then you can be penalized by Medicare. But if you actually save money at the end of that year and you're in the two-sided model, your incentives and your bonuses are higher than in the one-sided ACO model.
So, in principle, do you have, as a specialist, the option of not signing up for any ACO? I mean, just forego the potential savings, but also forego the potential downside?
Yeah, but then you're not going to have access to those patients, Roger. That's you may not have access
to those patients. Right.
You may, but you may not. If they stay within the ACO and you don't participate with any ACO groups, then that would be the concern for the specialist, that he might not have access to those patients.
I think it depends on the area of the country. If you're in Boston, which has a huge market penetration of ACOs, you will run the risk of having, you know, like Brock said, the access to the patients. They're all going to be caught up in all these ACOs. But if you're in an area where there's maybe one, I don't think it's that much of a concern. Because again, the patient can go to whomever they want. Now, the incentive for the primary care doctor is that they could give the patient a list of, these are the specialists, by the way, that participate in the ACO. Now, you don't have to go to them, but we're just going to give you this list. So they can't say you must go to these physicians, but they can certainly suggest that. And we've actually heard of instances where ACOs have actually sent letters to patients of ophthalmic practices and said that you can no longer go to Dr. X because he is not in the ACO. So I think the message that's really important for physicians to be aware of is that you need to educate your patients and have them understand, under an ACO concept, they have the ability to go to whomever they want. And if you find out that this is going on, you should send letters to your patients, because that's what this practice had to do. And we've tried to do a better job of working with CMS to educate the accountable care organizations as well as to what their requirements are and what they can and cannot do. And we talked about even working with ARP to get it out in their publications so that the Medicare population understands. And the other issue, or you know, the other point I want to make is that this whole exclusivity issue that Brock was talking about, we are still trying to get it corrected. So we have met with CMS, which is implementing this the way they're implementing it, three different times. The last meeting we had was with top officials, because they are moving Medicare into more of these types of models. And if you look at the SGR replacement proposal, it's all about moving physicians into these alternative payment models like ACOs, medical homes is another concept, as well as bundled payments. And we've been saying, if you want to do this and you want to get specialists involved in these payment models, you have to fix this problem. So this is not the end of the story, and we're still trying to get this changed so that ideally specialists could participate as a full participant, sharing in the savings and the risk with more than one ACO. That would be the ideal situation.
But the way it's kind of at least headed right now is the primary care groups have a very strong desire to have savings, not costs,
correct,
at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And the only way they can make that happen is to have the specialists be cooperative in a sense, in that they're equally incentivized.
Correct.
Am I getting that?
Yeah, I think there may be a disincentive to provide services, just like in HMOs originally, in order to save money and to potentially get a bigger bonus at the end of the year when it's looked back retrospectively.
Now, in addition to money, there are some kind of quality measures that are part of the CMS incentive, is that right?
Well, they actually have to participate in the PQR, that's the PQRS, which
right,
is the Physician Quality Reporting System, which, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, physicians have to report. Right now, there's still an incentive payment. There's a bonus payment, but that goes away starting in 2015, I believe. 2014 is the last year with a positive incentive, and in 2015, it becomes punitive if physicians don't participate. So if you're participating in the ACO has to also report on these quality measures as well. So
in Tucson, Brock, how many have the ACOs started to form, and how many
do you have? I think we have one ACO. I've not joined it yet. Actually, in Phoenix, there are about six ACOs present currently. That's only 110 miles from Tucson. So definitely the greater populated areas have the ACOs. I have a map of the ACOs, and most of it looks yellow, meaning there are no ACOs in it. But the metropolitan areas definitely are the highly populated areas are the ones that are going to have the ACOs. And
yeah.
I mean,
so it's a great big there's the potential at least to be a major barrier for patient access.
Yeah,
correct.
And the other point that I would like to make is that ACOs don't necessarily want ophthalmology either, because when you think about it, many of them are controlled by the hospitals, and we're not hospital-based. We're outpatient. Our services and our procedures are not, you know, they're not the high-dollar ticket items, if you will. And so I don't think they look at us and see a whole lot of savings. And so that's another issue, depending on where you are. You know, there's not so much of an interest to involve ophthalmology practices. So, you know, that's another point that we have made to people on the Hill and, you know, in the administration, that, you know, if you're going to, push us into these models, number one, you know, many of them, you know, we don't fit in neat and nicely into these concepts because, again, we're not the high-ticket items. We're not hospital-based. We're outpatient. We're pretty efficient, quite frankly, and we have great outcomes. They really need to be focusing on more of the, you know, chronic diseases, the big-ticket items like orthopedic surgery, cardiology, and so forth. So, you know, that's another issue as well, and depending on where you are in the country, like I said, the Boston area, they seem to have an interest in signing on with some ophthalmic practices, but in other parts of the country, they have not expressed an interest. So
I was just going to say, the whole thrust of the ACO is to provide great care to patients that have a lot of chronic diseases, to prevent readmission to hospitals. That's what saves them money. And so, like Nancy says, we don't really fit into that because we're not doing chronic disease management. We're doing specific procedurally based surgeries that provide very great results in a short period of time. So we're doing short bursts of treatment, not chronic disease management. So we don't fit into the ACO model very well.
You know, putting on my hat as coming from an academic medical center, of course, we've got a whole different set of threats, at least, and concerns, because you're right, we're still ambulatory, and yet we are part of the hospital-based system.
Right.
So we're kind of getting dragged along without any real input or playing a major role in the decision-making, and yet those decisions are potentially going to have a huge impact on our patient access, you know, and especially if you are kind of modeled as doing a reasonable amount of tertiary care, and suddenly things are carved up and patients at least are discouraged from coming to you, if not out and out prevented. You know, you worry that this is an added strain on a system that's already highly challenged to survive. And I don't, do you have any thoughts of where this is going for academic medicine, and not just even ophthalmology, just academic medicine in general.
I really don't. I don't. Maybe Brock does. I don't. You know, one thing I also would like to say is that, you know, these models are untested. There's no proof that they save money or improve quality. So that's a whole other big question mark.
Wasn't there a story that some of the model ACOs, you know, I'd heard this one or two years ago when they were modeling this. That
you're talking about the Pioneer?
Yeah, that most of them refused, once their contract was up, they said, I'm walking away from this, I'm not going to continue.
Yes, and those models were a little bit different, but yes, absolutely, they did not sign up, they did not re-sign. And so that's what I always say, is that, you know, these are untested models. Nobody knows if they save any money or improve quality of care. And again, you know, quality of care and improvement is hard to measure as well, and you have to have risk adjustment. I mean, we could have a whole conversation just on that. Properly risk adjustment, patient compliance is a huge issue. You know, how you have control over what the patient does. Let's just say, I'm going to use glaucoma as an example. So much of the outcome, if you will, depends on the patient continuing to be compliant, taking the drops, going to their visits, getting the pressure check, all of those things. It's very difficult, and you know, how can the physician be in total control of that? So those are the kinds of issues that we continue to raise on all these different models, because the medical home is very similar. The medical home is where the primary care doctor controls all the care. Do you see a theme here? It's all about primary care. And that really is the future. And if you look at all the different proposals, they're talking about primary care controlling everything, money being redistributed from specialty care back to primary care, that primary care can control. And like Brock said, you know, if you prevent the chronic diseases, you prevent them from being hospitalized and so forth. I mean, that is, you know, that is where we're headed, and that's what the thought process is. And the other point that I'd like to make is that this is bipartisan, and I think that's really important for people to realize that this is not a Democratic idea and it's not a Republican idea. It's both of them together. And so very few things in Washington are bipartisan these days. So these things are not going away. The trend is to reward physicians and pay them based on quality and outcomes and efficiencies. Even though a lot of these things have been untested, and that's the move, and away for fee-for-service. So even under this ACO model, which is based on fee-for-service right now, and Brock and I were actually talking about this, MedPAC, which is the advisory body to Congress, just had a meeting last week, and they were talking about the fact that ACOs, the way they're modeled now, based on fee-for-service, can they really control costs? Because they can't keep patients in the system. And so might they, a couple years from now, decide, you know what, we're going to change this? I mean, that could happen as well.
Yeah, well, you know, it is all experimental. Yeah. We really don't know that any of these models are going to pan out. And that's one of the things that's very frustrating, in that this is being thrust on us without it really being tested thoroughly. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure there are going to be modifications down the road. And but right now, it's kind of scary because we really don't know what to expect for the future.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that, as you know, has been said is that this is actually a straw man, and that the people who designed this designed it to fail, because when it fails, it'll push us into single payer.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, and well, no, but is that? I mean, is that far fetched? And I mean, because it's hard to see how this could go any other direction if it does not work the way it's structured. And you just pointed out at least the potential for it not working.
Well, now we're talking more just about the Affordable Care Act, I believe. You know, certain premiums are going up for patients than when they had minimal policies before, where they didn't have to pay as much. So now they have to pay more because of what's mandated by the ACA. And So, I forget your question.
Well, no, just about
single payer.
My point is, we have many more requirements now on the insurance companies. First of all, they can't pre-existing conditions. They can't...
It's a good thing.
That's a good thing. I'm just saying, no, that's a good thing. That's one of the good things that the policy did.
Right.
But I'm just saying it's going to cost the insurance companies more money. When they can't limit how much money they're going to pay for somebody's disease entity. So if they get cancer, they can't just stop paying on someone's breast cancer treatment. So the insurance companies are going to be laying out more money. Okay, yes, they're going to have more people coming to them, and they are going to collect more premiums from those because they're going to have higher enrollments. But they're also going to be outlaying a lot of money. And my concern is, if they have to outlay too much money, then our public insurance or our private insurance companies are going to go belly up, and we're going to be pushed into more of a single payer system with the federal government. That's my concern. I don't know if Nancy has the same concern or not. But.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of confusion about the ACA, and we had our government relations committee meeting the other day, and there's everybody's talking about the ACA. The ACA, is not Medicare. The ACA is about covering the uninsured. And again, eliminating pre-existing conditions. There are a lot of things the insurance companies have been doing and been getting away with and lining the pockets of, their executives. And it doesn't go into patient care. Mm-hmm. And not that I'm, a proponent of the Affordable Care Act, because, ASCRS actually opposed it for reasons we had, limited, didn't fix the SGR and so on and so forth. But basically, the concept is that if you get the young and the healthy uninsured into the system, into these different areas of the country, then you share the risk. And so then the insurance company can afford to, that's how they adjust it, because now they have all these healthy younger people who are not using the services that offset those that are the sick, sicker. So that's really the concept, the exchanges and so forth. And, it remains to be seen, what will happen, in the future. But many of these proposals were actually based on Republican ideas. The exchanges, the individual mandate, preserving the insurance companies in the marketplace are all actually Republican ideas that were, some of the proposals prior to this were Republican ideas. So, there's a lot of politics going on in Washington, as there always are, and so it'll be interesting to see what happens. But for ophthalmology, since about 70% of our patient population is really Medicare is really, to me, what we focus on. And many times, Medicare is what drives the market as well. A lot of the plans base their fee schedules off of the Medicare fee schedule. They negotiate off of it. Many times, Medicare is the higher payer. So it'll be interesting, to see what happens in the next couple of years.
Well, I appreciate both of you giving this time to try to lend some clarity. I mean, and a year ago, even 6 months ago, none of this was even remotely understood, maybe by you two, but certainly not the rest of us.
Right.
Now it's at least starting to become a little clearer.
Mm-hmm.
Not less threatening, but at least clearer.
Right.
And we'll and of course this has, as you said, this is not, we're right now in the midst as we sit here at the uh-huh. Academy of all this noise about the failure of the website and signing up. But that's for the, as you pointed out, just for clarity, that's the uninsured getting insurance, which is really separate from the ACO issue.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Correct.
That is
correct. Yeah. So these are just different components of this plan that we're all going to be learning about. The hard way.
That's right.
Yeah. So, I'd like to thank you both, as I said, for joining us.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you very much.
And this is Dr. Roger Steiner. I've been joined by Nancy McCann and Dr. Brock Bakewell on behalf of Medscape Ophthalmology. Thank you very much.